Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, a conversation with actor Gabriel Byrne. We've long admired Byrne for his nuanced performances in films like The Usual Suspects, Miller's Crossing, and the television series In Treatment. Byrne's acting style is thoughtful and deeply moving. The word understated comes to mind. The same is true of his writing. His new memoir, Walking with Ghosts, is far from a celebrity tell-all. The prose is evocative, and Byrne reflects meaningfully on his life and career, moving back and forth in time between his childhood in Ireland and his days as a young actor. On January 12th, 2021, Gabriel Byrne talked to Stephen Wynn about acting, on stage and on the screen, and the spiritual power of listening. It was the sort of conversation we most hoped for with an artist as introspective as Byrne. Join us now for a conversation with Gabriel Byrne.
Thank you. And Gabriel, thank you for being here with us.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here. Yeah, thank you.
I wanted to start actually with something that many things I learned from reading your book and preparing for this is that despite your long and prolific career, you're actually kind of a late starter as an actor, not really getting going until you were in your late 20s. And before that, having done many jobs ranging from a toilet attendant to plumber to an archaeologist to a teacher, tell me how you made the turn when acting really kicked in for you.
Dublin at that time, I suppose I was in my mid-20s, and Dublin at that time was not a terribly exciting place. I remember it as being grey and dull and without excitement. Most social life took place in the pub, and I had always been interested in the theatre and in film. I mean, going to theatres. And one day I remember somebody said to me just casually, why don't you join an amateur drama group? And the thought of it made me so nervous that I just dismissed it out of hand. The idea of actually becoming an amateur drama actor and being on stage in front of people just kind of scared me so much I let it go. And then somebody said it to me again, and they were actually going to this place. So I said, I'll go with them. At the last moment, I chickened out and let the guy go in by myself. But to cut a long story short, I eventually did get to that door and I knocked on it. And do you know the way sometimes the great events of your life are what you think are inconsequential decisions, minuscule moments that have the effect of changing your life? Well, the knock on that door and my willingness to stay there and not run actually changed my life. Because when I went into that door, through that door, and sat around a table and read the play and had biscuits and tea with these people, I felt, it sounds a bit hokey to say this, but I felt that I was, that I'd reached somewhere where I could be comfortable. And I was talking to people, even though I was overawed by the fact that they were amateur actors, I was overawed by them, but I still felt that I was connected to them in a way that I never was in the pub or in jobs or anything else. So that's how I began my acting career in Dublin, in the amateur drama circle.
Well, like a lot of actors, as you describe yourself in the book, you were shy and self-conscious person as a child, and maybe that continued. It's a very typical pattern for actors, isn't it? That their social unease out in the real world somehow gets mitigated or released in the theater. Was that true for you?
Yeah, I can't explain really what it is that makes people act. My mother dragged me out from under the bed by my leg to go downstairs and play the accordion for my Uncle Harry when I was about 5. And I still feel like that. Anytime I'm asked to do something, I'm metaphorically under that bed being pulled out by the leg. Because my instinct is to be not in a room with people. And with a lot of people I don't know. They say that acting is the shy man's revenge. And there's a lot of truth in that. But how people can go from being very shy to being what looks like the uninhibited center of attention is something I don't understand. I really, truly don't. Nor do I understand how acting happens or even writing. I don't understand it. And I've spoken to many actors about this and I've said, do you feel insecure or ill at ease when you're not on the stage? And some of them said, both on the stage and off the stage. But I think it's the fact that you can assume an identity that's not you. So you are not being out there being criticized. The character is what you can unconsciously present to the audience and say, this is me. And in a way, if acting is really successful, when it's really working, I think, The ideal is to act like children play, unselfconsciously, not judging, imagination at full stretch, utterly involved in the process. If you ever pass a playground and look at kids playing, it's fascinating to watch how unaware they are of everything. And they are so absorbed in what they're doing. And they so believe in the world that they've created. And it can be like a stick can be, a spear or whatever it is. To be able to act like that would be the goal that you would aspire to. You never actually get to that place, well, at least only rarely. But the shyness never actually goes away. I don't know what shyness is, really. Is it the fear of rejection, or the inability to feel that one deserves a place in the group for some reason? I don't know, but I'm still shy to this day.
Mm. You tell a great story about an actor who goes unnamed in the book, who had one of those magical nights when he performed in this peak transcendent way. Mm. And afterwards was in his dressing room weeping because he said he didn't know how he did it.
Yes.
And I wonder if for you, you've had those moments where you feel you've sort of stepped out of yourself in some new way, peak experiences, whether it was in the theater or on film, where the flow, you were in the flow in ways that you just couldn't account for. It just happened in some way. Have you had experiences like that as an actor?
I know this sounds contradictory to what we've been saying, but I have to be very careful when I feel like that, because you can't actually trust that. I have felt sometimes, not too often, but I felt, oh my God, this is just going so well. This is what I, because the actor's brain is fragmented. Like all our brains are fragmented. We can be doing something, but at the back of your head, there's a version of, did I leave the kettle on? So, those moments when you feel completely transported are sometimes you're not transported at all. It's not actually good. And then the moments when you think, God, that didn't go really well at all, is maybe the moment when it did go well. What I'm saying is that you have to be humble before the process. And you have to say, the process isn't about whether I think it's good or bad in the moment. My job is to submit to the process and allow myself to be in it non-judgmentally.
Do other actors, is this something you talk about with other actors, or is it kind of a superstition not to do that or not to try to probe too deeply into what the process really is?
I never went to drama school, so I don't know if those kinds of conversations happen there, but most actors, I think, don't like to talk about the process of acting itself. And I think a great deal of that is because they don't understand it. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way. It's just very difficult to say, why should this guy be able to do to make Hamlet real and alive and vital and emotional, and this other guy, despite everything that he possibly do, years and years of study, cannot do that? I just don't, to this day, I don't understand it.
So when you're watching other actors or working with other actors, whether as a member of the audience or someone you're playing with, are you aware of their technique? Are you thinking about that at all? Is that something that, I know why he's doing that. I know why that particular gesture is there. I know why this particular beat in the line delivery is there, or not.
Well, I worked with an actor in a very long play once, where he came on at the beginning of Act One and started doing the lines for Act Three. And a lot had happened at the in all through Act One and Act Two.
As it often does.
As it often does. So he was saying, I can't remember the exact thing, but he was talking about how sad that this man had died, who was actually sitting in the chair in front of him, and very much alive in the play, and trying to head him off and bring him back to was, I think, some of our best acting in that entire run of the play. Without giving too much of it away, I think that, and I think I talked a little bit about this in the book, the idea that you're completely subsumed, you know, with this idea of being transported into this other character is erroneous. Your brain is actually working on several different levels. What is the next line? Is that that pause that he gave, is that pause meant to be there, or has he forgotten his line? Why is he looking at me like that? Oh, Jesus, it's my line. I have got to go over here now and pick up the glass. Those three guys in the second row are talking to each other. The lights come on a bit too soon there. Are we going too fast? They didn't laugh at that. They laughed at it last night. So overlaying all that chaos is the swan of the actor going on the river. Or maybe a duck, maybe not a swan, but a duck going along the water, and his paddles or his webs or whatever you call them, feet, are going like this under the water. But the glide is all that people see, hopefully. Because the audience will give you, they'll give you a certain amount of time before they actually begin to cop on that there's been a mistake. And if it's not a Pinter play and you're allowed to pause legitimately, if it's not a Pinter play, they'll give you a certain, and then they start to realize something is wrong. And that spreads to the audience like wildfire, and the actor feels it. So it's compounded by the fact that they know you've made a mistake.
Of course, in a Pinter play, Act Three sometimes sounds like Act One, or vice versa. So
there's some plays where it doesn't matter whether you're in Act One or Act Three.
It doesn't matter.
It might improve the play.
We're talking about the live theater, of course, here. So different when you're working in either film or television, where the audience is a bunch of people with earphones on and wheeling cameras around and things like that. How did you find the transition from live theater to film acting and acting on television?
Well, my film debut was with John Borman in a film called Excalibur. And as I say in the book, every lawyer in Dublin was up on a horse in that film, because they were all asked, could they ride a horse? And of course, they all said yes, including me. And we were put up on these polo ponies in suits of armor. And it was like being inside... It was like being inside a post box strapped to a horse. because the only thing I could see was this little piece of the world. I'd never ridden a horse before. And eagle-eyed equestrians will look at this film and say, my God, because you're supposed to glide up to a mark. And if you watch any of the old cowboy guys, you know, they have the reins in one hand and they're kind of looking out that way and looking over that way. And the horse, because they knew what they were doing, and they would glide to their marks. And sometimes they'd lean on their saddles. And sometimes they'd be like, they have a bit of a cigarette and they'd throw it away. Well, me and all the other lawyers of Dublin, we had no such grace. So we would bound up to these marks, being shaken like tin cans on these horses. In some cases, just toppling over into the muck. Poor old John Boorman realised the amount of incompetence that he had hired. Well, I thought, you see, that when you went on a set, on a film set, they put the camera down and it recorded all the angles. Just like in the theatre, you didn't look this way and that way and look out there in the theatre. You went on, you performed, and it was over. The curtain came down. So when I went on the set, they did this big shot where I was way, 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 way at the back. I learned a lot of lessons on that film. Number one was that the guy who I was with said, you don't have to be doing everything. We're a half a mile away. You don't have to be giving it the full shilling at this stage of the game.
Wait, stop acting. Here.
Stop. Nobody can see you. Just get through the mud with your suit of armor. So so when I got there, I thought, well, that didn't take long. What are they talking about, these things where you know, movies take forever to do? And then there was a big break of an hour. I thought, what are we coming back? Didn't we do this already? Well, of course, we were only beginning the 3 days of doing the same scene over and over again. When it finally came to my close-up and I was exhausted by acting a mile away, they put me on top of this ladder to do the close-ups. And I was too afraid to ask anybody why, for the last 2 days, I'd been on a horse saying these lines. And now I was on top of a ladder saying these lines and there was nobody around me. And they said, well, we're doing this for your close-up. And I didn't know what close-up actually meant either. But I soon discovered, you know, that being in close-up was the one that really mattered if they were going to use it. And one of the actors said to me, you don't have to, like, and I said, oh, God, I was back there and you were telling me I shouldn't be doing. Now I'm up here on top of a ladder and you're telling me I shouldn't be doing too much. I was in tears at the end of those days because I didn't want to betray my ignorance either by saying I don't know what's going on here. And I recount in the book also a story that John Boorman often talks about where, again, I had to have my way. Let's put it like that. I had to have my way with this maiden called Egrain, and I was the evil, brutish warlord who came in and took her against her will. And in this huge suit of armor with spikes and in front of a fire, and I did the first 5 or 6 takes. The sweat was rolling off me. And then they said, okay, that's fine, Gabriel. And they took the girl out and they put in a pink cushion underneath me. And I was looking, waiting for her to come back. And they said, and action. And I said, excuse me, they said, no, the cushion, she's gone. This is a close-up. You have to do it with the cushion. You talk about being shy. You talk about being mortified. Have you ever tried to hump a pink cushion in a suit of armor?
In front of a big crew as well.
Yes, yes, in front of a crew throwing their eyes to heaven. You haven't really lived until you've done that. But I learned pretty quickly, I have to say.
Well, you must have been a quick start. It's all sort of in the category of not wanting to know how the sausage is made, isn't it?
Exactly. I do, you know, people who come on sets. I remember my brother, who's an ambulance driver in Dublin. I wanted him to see, you know, what filmmaking was like. He'd worked as a fireman for 30 years of his life. And we were shooting this film in England called Defence of the Realm. And we had a scene on a low loader. For people who don't know what a low loader, it's a thing that attaches to the camera car that gives the illusion that you're driving. And so you're not actually driving, you're just in this car pretending to drive. So we drove around all the motorways and we'd stop, and the mayor hair and makeup would come in and do the business. So he was on the low loader watching me do this. So we pulled in at this little station, a little gas station, and I said to him, so what do you think? He said, "Jeez, I don't know how you do it. I just don't know how you do it. How many more hours do we have of this?" And I said, "Well, you know, another 5. He said, "Jeez, I'd rather go to a fire any day." And he said, and you have the life, though. He said, "You don't even have to comb your own hair." Because he thought, like, that hair and makeup was something that, you know, I was so, you know, like, "Do my hair, please. Put on my makeup." Anyway.
One of the stories you tell about, of speaking about the ordeal of making movies, is in passing talking about In Treatment, that the shooting schedule for that was brutal. You shot 14-hour days sometimes in that series. Why was that? Why was that such a grueling regimen to create that show?
Because there was only 2 actors at any given time. So it was very much more like theater. It was a combination of theater and film. I never actually thought of it as TV in a way. I thought of it as the discipline of the theater allied with the technique of film. Because you were in close-up all the time, so you didn't need to do terribly much. You had to listen, and you had to listen really well. And listening is a form of acting, in my opinion, listening really well. And, there would be 35 pages of dialogue every 2 days. And that was, I found it very, very draining and demanding, because there was no relief from it. But at the end of 5 months, I have to say that I was truly exhausted from the whole process.
I mean, one of the things that's wonderful about that series and your performance is that intimacy, that the way that your performance modulated to, I mean, the first season with Mia Wasikowska was just fantastic. And then you season with Blair Underwood. And then when your character goes to a therapist with Diane Wiest, what were you tapping to play that role? Had you yourself been in psychotherapy? Was that something that you were able to tap? Or how did you get at a role which is, as you say, a lot about listening?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know that Freud said that the only nation on earth that couldn't be psychoanalyzed were the Irish. He actually did say that. And I think the reason he said it was because the Catholic Church and confession is a version of therapy where you go to this person who listens to your travails and your sins. And it's a very basic form of therapy, I suppose, forgives you for the wrongs that you've done and gives you a penance that you do and until you're back again a week later, having committed the same sins. But the idea is very close to therapy. And I used to see what you could see in the darkness of these priests behind the grill. Some of them were listening and some of them would be asleep and some of them would not be listening at all. But I always remember the ones who listened. And somebody said, a little bit grandiosely, I think, that true listening is a form of prayer. And it is such a respectful thing to do to another person, to really listen to what they're saying and to hear them. And I had no idea how to play the role until the night before we were to start shooting. And I saw a man and a woman in a cafe window, and she was talking and he was listening. And as the car was stopped at the traffic lights, and I looked in, and that's it, listening. That's what my character is about. And so I tried to turn that listening into something dramatic.
And succeeded wonderfully. I watched The Usual Suspects the other night, Miller's Crossing. Mm. And in some ways, the way you play, particularly with Albert Finney and John Turturro in those scenes, there's a kind of calm in your character, even though the depths are great there, while there's this more sort of flamboyant acting going on. It's something that you're quite good at, sort of maintaining calm, I guess is the word for it, or a kind of solidity or depth or something. I guess people would think of it as underacting. I wonder if it's something that you've thought about, in not just in treatment, but some of your other roles as well.
It's the kind of acting I like, where, and I'm not saying that I do this successfully at all, but I like the audience to do the work to a great extent, because their imagination is involved. If you're watching a performance and you can say to yourself, I wonder what's he thinking there? What's he really thinking about? That's good. I think that allowing the audience to be part of what you're doing is exciting, by not feeding them everything, by not saying, okay, here's the moment that you should really. And the great, great actors that I've admired over the years have been masters of that. And you watch them and you look and you say, now, what is he doing there? He's actually doing nothing. And then but he's not doing nothing, because to do less is a rejection of 25 different options, to say, this is what I'll do here. And
who would some of those actors be in that category of?
Well, in the old days, you know, some of the old timers, somebody like Spencer Tracy, who always looked as if he always looked as if he was not doing anything, but he was actually, of course, utterly connected. If you watch a movie, say with him, like not one of the ones with Catherine Hepburn, where he was playing a kind of a comedy role, but say Bad Day at Black Rock, where he walks in among all those classic gangstery guys and he does almost nothing. He walks up to the bar and he's got one arm, I think, and he just orders his drink and you're waiting for something to happen. That's another great one. What's going to happen here? Well, when I did that first scene with John Turturro in Miller's Crossing, the very first morning, a Monday morning in New Orleans, when everybody, including the guy who makes the tea, was nervous because it was a Coen Brothers film, a huge undertaking. And John Turturro sat opposite me and peeled an apple with a penknife, and managed to peel the apple without splitting the skin. And then wiped his penknife with a handkerchief, put it back in his pocket. And I looked at him and I thought, my God, the calm and the concentration and the nerves that took to do that on the first morning. So I don't know where, again, these things come from, but I called Joel and I was sitting opposite him and I said, look, Joel, do you think it would be okay if I took my hat off? Because the hat plays a big role in that film. And I threw the hat, and without looking at it, it landed on my shoe. He said, try it. And I did it. And I'm very proud of that moment, not because the hat landed on the shoe, but that I jumped into the cold water so quickly to say, I'll try and do something that will really test my nerve, because if I can do that and get away with that, the rest of the film might be a little bit easier. And, you know, as it went on, I gain the confidence to do things. There's a scene in it where I light a match off a cop's badge, which I saw Paul Muni do in Scarface, in the original Scarface. And in that film, it looks like he just strikes the match and lights a cigarette. But of course, I didn't realize they'd got to prime the badge and put sulfur in there and do all kinds of things. But it was a cool moment to be able to do little things like that, because around me there were very flamboyant, brilliant actors.
One thing that you have said, and it comes up in the book, the reason I thought of The Usual Suspects, because you tell a great story about that movie opening at Cannes and how you responded to success, which you have been, I think it's fair to say, ambivalent about success and fame and some of your reputation over the years, that it threw you into this really kind of a tailspin, a kind of a maelstrom of that. I wonder if you just talk a little bit about that, and more generally about how you feel about how you're seen in the world because of your celebrity.
Well, there's two interesting questions you've asked there. For people who haven't seen The Usual Suspects, it premiered at Cannes in 95 or 96. I can't actually remember. But we got a standing ovation for the film. We shot it in 28 days. We didn't really think it was going to be anything, really, but it became this sensation at Cannes. As soon as the film was shown, we were five completely different people. We were suddenly inundated at the after party. We were celebrated, and celebrated meant your pockets full of phone numbers, people talking to you, wanting to buy you drinks, holding on to you, all that kind of stuff. The reason I fled that occasion, I had, I suppose, what you might call a panic attack, and fled and went to Nice and locked myself in a hotel bedroom, you know, 50 miles away or whatever it was, and stayed there for 3 days with the curtains closed, was because the panic was caused by, I think, an attack I perceived unconsciously on my identity. And the reason that made a difference to me was because when I went to school in Ireland, which I talk about in the book, I think that the early years of a child's life should be about the benign construction of an identity, where the child is encouraged and nurtured and move towards things that challenge him and so forth. But Irish education and Irish Catholicism were not like that. In fact, it was about the deconstruction of identity and the imposition of religious and educational rules on top of you as a child. And the punishment for not adhering to that were very grave, eternal damnation, etc. So I came out of that system and I tried to construct another identity for myself. It took me a lot of years to do that because, as the Jesuits so famously say, give us a child till he's seven and he's ours for life. And that's absolutely true. The inculcation and the propaganda and the fear produced this very fragile identity. I tried to construct another one, and I thought I had that. And then when I went into acting, I realized that identity was a major part of this job, because how you were perceived altered your identity. So a producer took me aside at this party and he said, which was something that made me actually squirm, really. He said, you're a star now. Wave bye-bye to your anonymity. And that freaked me completely, because I thought, well, who am I going to be then? Who is this person standing in the middle of a party being lionized by these people? And I fled. I realized, as somebody pointed out to me later on, I wasn't fleeing from that. I was actually distancing myself from what I perceived to be this identity that was being created for me. And that was wrapped up in the notion of fame. And fame was something that I was extremely wary of and distrusted. And I had seen the effects of fame on people that I had worked with before then, very, very famous people, and how it freaked them and how it made them wary and on edge and not able to go down to the shop for a coffee, and how people changed around them and how they didn't know who they were anymore. I'm not saying all of them, but the ones that I had looked at close quarters, they want me to be this, but I'm this. They want me to do that kind of a film, but I don't want to do that kind of a film. You have to go to Hollywood, but I don't want to go to Hollywood. All these things. And so it was really an assault on identity. And one of the themes in the book is about identity. And I write in one of the earlier chapters about when I lived in New York, and I lived in the 24th floor of a building. And you would come up in the elevator and this wind would whoosh, and then there was silence. And I looked out and I saw in all these apartment blocks around me, silent movies, just people's lives being acted out in silence that I was not part of. And yet, if they could look at me, they would see me in that room where I was. And a couple, one night I was pulling the curtains, this is in the book for anybody who hasn't read it, but I was pulling the curtains in my apartment, and just as I was about to close them, I looked and I saw these two people fall through a door, kissing like crazy, pulling the clothes off each other. And I thought, well, I've got to close. No, don't close the curtains. Look, see, you never know. You could be doing it wrong. You never know. Just look and see what these people are doing. But I was curious. I wasn't voyeuristic in that sense. I was really curious to see. Anyway, they went to the bed. I turned off the light in my room. They went to the bed. They made love. It didn't last terribly long. The man got out of the bed. The woman got out of the bed. The man remained in the bed, changing channels. She went and she got coffee. She brought it back to him. He lit a cigarette. And I closed the curtains. There was a cafe in the building next door, and I went in there, and I walked in, and the two people I'd seen making love, were at the counter. And the man turns and looks at me, and he says, "Don't I know you from somewhere?" And I was thinking to myself, "Yeah, but I know you." But he said, "Who are you?" And I said, I live in that building next door. And the girl said, no. I know him from somewhere. And I thought, oh, Jesus, don't tell me that they saw me looking through the window. She said, no. Tell us, who are you? We know who you are. And that to me again was about, you're living this life in this tower where you can't connect with anybody. You walk down and somebody says, who are you? Well, the biggest question in life, as Plato or Socrates said, is, you know, nosce tibi ipsum, know thyself. Who am I? Who are you? And that's one of the things in response to your earlier question, like what acting does. It makes you think about what identity is. Who are you? Who are you in this situation? Do you really know who you are or what you are? Are you heroic? Do you think you're heroic? Would you be the one who, in a crash plane, goes back in and pulls people out? Or would you be somebody who just says, there's nobody here, I better save myself? We don't know the answer to that. So when that initial burst of fame or whatever it is came to me, my instinct was to run.
It's a great story in the book, and it's so powerful, as you've just explained it at several levels. One, the idea of you're just famous, but who are you? I know you're famous, but I don't know who you are,
right.
Which isn't just a question for actors, but as you say, it's who are we? And
yes.
your wonderful book is just full of things like that. Let me ask you, let's turn it specifically to the book. You had written an earlier memoir back in about 25 years ago, which I confess I have not read.
No, and you don't have to read it, Steve. You don't have to read it.
But I wonder what, you know, what induced you to write this time, and what have you learned in those 25 years, that insights about yourself that maybe you didn't have 25 years ago and that are so exquisitely put here?
I think what I wanted to write about were the things that I felt dictated the life that I've led. One is identity. The other is time, memory, imagination. And in order to do that, what I tried to do was construct my memories around those themes. I write about when a young friend of mine is drowned and he dies. And I went to my room. I remember I was 9 or 10 and I cried. And that was the first time I cried for another person. Up until then, I had cried for myself. You know, you took my apple or whatever it was. This was a moving outside oneself to realize that somebody else was gone. In the scene where I write about the fairground, and when the fairground is over, my father and my brother are leaving it. And my brother said, that was the best day of our lives. When is the next one? And my father says, no, that's a centenary. We'll be all dead and gone by the time that the next one comes around. And at the edge of my consciousness was this idea, in coupling with this drowning, that death was out there. And time was passing. And in the last part of the book, when I go into the dressing room on Broadway, about a clock that's ticking from 7:30 to 8, those minutes are a different version of time. And then how time is suspended when you walk into the imaginary dream of a play. But memory and imagination are very, very close to each other. And I wanted to remain true to the details of what happened. And so I try to create the sights, the sounds, the smells, the dialogue of the world that I grew up in. And I wanted to really be ruthless in looking at my own self on that journey. And I think one of the differences between a memoir and a novel is that a novel allows you freedom. You can pepper your opinions of the world through characters, and you can step back and say, in a bit like the way we talked about acting, it wasn't me, it was the character who said that. In memoir, you're confronted on every page, is this the truth? And if it is the truth, do I want to say it? And if I say it, how are people going to judge me about this? And if I write about the things that I've battled against in my life, how is that going to make me seem to people? But I decided to do it anyway, because I do believe, you asked me what I learned. One of the things I've learned is that secrecy and silence and shame are utterly destructive, and that they will eat into your soul and they will destroy you. So if you can empower yourself by not being silent, by admitting that, listen, I'm a human being. These things happen to me. I'm not a bad person, really. And even if I did bad things, what was I doing them for? Like I talk about when I was not a very good thief, but I was a thief. And I was stealing things and stealing money and buying suits and, you know, putting money on cars and things. But to be truthful, I didn't want it to be sentimental. I didn't want it to be nostalgic. I didn't want it to be funny in the sense that, oh, let's turn this into a witty or funny anecdote, because that's where the story ends. The story ends there. It's not about inventing, you know, a scenario after that. And so anytime I felt that I was faking it, I pulled it out and went back to the drawing board again and said, that's not true.
Well, the truthfulness of it is stunning. I mean, one of the things, of course, you talk about is the abuse you suffered at the hands of a priest. But equally powerful are your own confessions of having bullied a fellow student, which it's both of those episodes are gripping for their truthfulness. We're getting a question from an audience member here asking if there was anything you considered writing about but didn't include in the memoir, and anything you would like to want to add to the book if you had another shot at it. Were there things that you shied away from or that you didn't feel... I mean, it's not a celebrity memoir at all. I mean, it's a very personal book that toggles back and forth from your childhood to your professional life and very, very effectively. But I'm wondering if, as the audience member does, are there things that you shied away from for one reason or another?
I didn't want to write about anybody that I'd worked with. And I didn't want to know, I didn't want to write about any of the things that I had witnessed on film sets over 40 years, because to me they're private moments. I have no right to betray people's confidences by doing that, and I would never write a book like that. So I stayed away from all that. The reason I mention Laurence Olivier in the book is because, again, that story. Where I said to him, the only thing I could think of saying to Laurence Olivier, who was a true hero of mine when I met him in the hallway, was I couldn't think of that. And I said, excuse me, do you have the time? And he said, are they paying you on this thing? And I said, yes, they are. He said, well, buy yourself a watch. And I thought, Jesus, I never meet your heroes. Wow, that's a bit of a bollocky thing to say. Anyway, he came back before he left, and he left me a little note, and on the note it said, I apologize for being so abrupt. I was trying to put lines in my head. He was learning his lines. He said, but I've thought about what you asked me. Do I have the time? And he wrote out Sonnet 60, like as the waves make toward the pebble shore. I think I can't remember the kind, but the sonnet was about time and how time was running out for him. And that's the reason I mentioned him. So it wasn't that I said, oh, I'll name drop Laurence Olivier. The reason to mention him was that. But in response to your viewer's question, there wasn't anything that I left out. I wanted to make everything succinct. I didn't want to be going on forever about how I got sober and, you know, falling off the horse on the road to Damascus. And, you know, I just wanted to say, this is what happened. And I was dying, and I didn't want to keep dying and dying this way. So I decided that I wanted to live. I think it's a bit like what we talked about in relation to acting. Let the audience come in and fill in what's there. Leave it so that you're not telling them too much, so that they can bring their own imagination to it.
I was just about to make that point exactly, that it's exactly what you do in this book so well. I know that you have mentioned in elsewhere that both Houseman and Wordsworth were sort of in your head as inspirations or figures that you were emulating. A couple of other writers came to mind when I was reading the book. One is William Trevor, who does that so well, as you do, that sort of elliptical telling detail that just recurs over and over again. And then, not to embarrass you, but the structure of the book of walking around and visiting your old sites in Dublin can't help but recall Joyce's Ulysses a little bit, that same peregrination around Dublin. I don't know if either of those writers were in your head, but they certainly resonated for me as a reader. It's just a splendid book.
I mean, you couldn't give me a bigger compliment than that. I mean, somebody said to Joyce once, you know, do you miss Dublin? And he said, Do you miss Dublin after being out of it for 40 years? And he said, I never left it. And what he meant was, of course, that he'd never left it in memory. But our relationship with home and with where we're brought up is it's a very conflicted, fragile, fragmented relationship. And the panorama at the beginning of the book is about a landscape that has changed, but it's also the landscape of memory. And it's what is the landscape of memory? It's the past. And what is the past? The past is time. William Trevor writes beautifully about the past. He's almost a poetic, almost like a poet in prose, I would say, William Trevor. And Joyce, Joyce, of course, who was in exile all his life, Dublin became even more important to him as a source of inspiration. Somebody quoted Louise Gluck, the Nobel Prize-winning poet, who said that we see childhood, we see life once in childhood. And after that, it's a memory. I think that's a beautiful quote, because we are looking back to that first time when our senses were alive and flowering, and everything made huge impression on us because we were so impressionable.
I mean, it's so striking, your sensory recall of those things. I take it for you, Dublin is very much in your being, just as it was for Joyce. You may have lived away from it for decades, but it still clearly, as the book demonstrates, very much in your psyche, in yourself.
Yeah, well, where you come from and home are often, so some people leave and they say, well, I was born there, but home. And what home means, I think home is one of the most powerful primitive impulses we have, the desire to go home, like the salmon or the bird flying from one side of the world to the other. Even religion understands that. And mythology, the great mythical stories, are all about returning home to that place where you are at one with yourself. In religion, in the Catholic religion anyway, the idea of our eternal home is heaven, Valhalla. So many religions have that idea. That's another thing that motivated me to write the book. What is my relationship to home? Where am I at home? Who am I when I'm not in that place that I called home? And one of the things that I have learned living as an immigrant or an immigrant or an exile, or as it says in my passport, what do they call it? A resident alien. That's what I'm defined as when I go up to the booth at Kennedy Airport.
Kind of an oxymoron,
Exactly. But it's almost like aliens this way, real people go
isn't
that way. And I'm described as that. And my sense of it is this, that home does not exist for me, and home is a place that you must carry within yourself if you're to have some kind of peace. If you're ha is it, if you're trying to reconcile where you've left with where you are. Because where you've left is always where there's a part of you going to be. Even if you come from Texas to San Francisco, and you meet somebody else from Texas, you're going to say, oh, do you remember that guy who lived in Dallas, the guy with the big ears? And you say, yeah. Well, saying that to somebody in San Francisco, you say, oh, I knew a guy with big ears from Dallas. They'd say, oh, yeah. But that connection, that landscape, that sense of not having to explain yourself. Because when you are not in the place that you're from, you have to shut down a great deal of yourself. And that culturally has an effect on how you develop and grow as an exile. And in some cultures, people ghettoized because they didn't want to lose that sense of home and belonging. I don't think I ever ghettoized, you know, because I was always, I think, too much of a... I always wanted to go my own way, you know.
We brushed on it earlier a bit about the role of the Catholic Church in your life. You, when you were 11, you went off to seminary thinking that the priesthood was your calling off to England. It's another touching, wrenching, revealing episode in the story. The Catholic Church has a very different weight for you now. I wonder if you talk a little bit about your that early experience and what you feel about the church now and what its significance or importance for you. And it's,
well, first of all, I have no axe to grind in relation to people who follow any religion. That is their business. I happen not to follow any religion. Look, this is an institution that that does not acknowledge women, the role of women in the church. It's an institution that doesn't recognize divorce. It doesn't recognize sex outside marriage. It has an extremely appalling record in relation to homosexuality. There are so many reasons to dislike the Catholic Church. I just read today, 9,000 children in Ireland between 1933 and 1969, 9,000 children died in clerical institutions. And they were buried. Some of them were buried in drains outside the convent. And they were only discovered by accident 4 or 5 years ago, because these children were born outside wedlock and the women were treated like dirt, and the children were taken from them and sent away to America. And the mothers never knew where the children were, and the children never knew who the mothers were. What a crime to commit against, you know, humanity. And they introduced this thing called celibacy, which means that the priest cannot be married, or the nun cannot be married, but the nun can be married to God, which is some marriage. But anyway, she's married to God. She has a ring on her finger that says, you know, Jesus is my husband. But the idea that you don't let priests marry was introduced in the 11th or 13th century, I can't remember. Christ never came down on the earth and said, listen, you know, you guys can't get married to women because women are bad news. He didn't say that. It was introduced for purely mercenary reasons in the 11th or 13th century. So men now are prevented from loving another person by the Catholic Church. That's a crime to me. That you prevent people from loving each other, and that is a sin that you can go technically to hell for. You know, they don't speak out enough and act enough in terms of the politics of the world that we're living in. You know, but on the positive side, what they do is they provide a framework, a positive framework for people to live within. They provide very simple answers to extremely complex questions. And if your journey in life is, well, it's God's will, or God never closes one door, but he opens another and stuff like that, and that you're going to go to heaven, and if you keep your slate clean, you won't go to hell. It can be comforting to live a life like that. But I feel very deeply about abortion. I feel very deeply about euthanasia. I feel very deeply about celibacy and priests being allowed to live. I believe that a woman should have the absolute right to decide what she does with her body. And I believe that we as people should have the right to decide how we end our lives. Because if your body doesn't belong to you, what does? So I don't want people telling me that in matters of faith and morals, they know what's going on, because they don't. I know what's going on, and I know that the only true religion really is about connecting with your fellow man and being human and being doing as much good as you can and being kind. Beyond that, nobody knows anything. As Shakespeare said, you know, that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns.
Gabriel, we've talked about your past. Let's touch a little bit about your future. What are you looking forward to? You're working on the novel, and what kind of acting are you looking forward to? You're anticipating, and just to backtrack a little bit, I want to ask you about the kind of roles, what it is in a script that you see that appeals to you. What seems to light the fire for you in a role?
Well, maybe mistakenly, I don't know, but it's always been about, what's this script trying to say? What's it about? I would say 98% of the projects that I've chosen have been about that. I've never worried about box office. I've never worried about, will this, be good for my career. I look at the script and I say, I want to be part of pushing this out into the world if I can. I made mistakes by doing that. I basically handed an Academy Award to another actor by turning down something. And then with that same actor, I turned down another that he did as well. And I look at that and I think, you could spend time regretting that and saying, oh, maybe I should have done that. But it's always been about that for me. In terms of the future, I don't have any desire to play any role, really. I never did. I mean, the roles that I wanted to play, on the stage, and I never felt, oh, I need to play. No. I just finished a film where I play a professor of poetry who's going back to find his love of the past, his lover in the past time. And it's based on the music of Leonard Cohen, specifically on an album called Death of a Ladies' Man. And I play a ladies' man who's dying, and a man who's looking back at his life and saying, you know, I used to be, and I was, and now I'm not anymore. But when you put the music of Leonard Cohen to a film, it brings it up, you know, to a level that it's very moving, you know. And Cohen signed off on it before he died and said, I don't know what this is about, what you guys are trying to do, but we were really doing his story, because he went back to find the love of his life towards the end of his days there. And so that's coming out. And I do this thing called War of the Worlds, the H.G. Wells thing I do. I might be going back to do a season of that. But I'm going to go back to the stage in November in Dublin. I think it's not finalized yet, but I think that's where I'm headed.
I have to ask you before we go about O'Neill. I was lucky enough to see you opposite Cherry Jones in A Moon for the Misbegotten on Broadway 20 years ago. Very memorable. And O'Neill is someone you've returned to. You've done Long Day's Journey. You did Touch of the Poet. Tell me what O'Neill means to you, what that playwright who seems really central to your stage career.
All of O'Neill's plays, I think, they deal with really powerful, fundamental preoccupations of all of us. The really deep things, love, regret, life, death, the really heavy themes. He sprinkles it with humor, but it's essentially a meditation on the complexity of life. O'Neill's theory was that we all wear masks. And what's tragic is that other people wear masks too. And what his dramas do is they take the mask off. Each character has the mask taken off. And they are revealed to be who they are. And in the recognition of their humanity, of their universal humanity, it's moving for an audience to say, "That's, I know that feeling. I know what that means." He was very brutally honest in his writing. For example, in Moon for the Misbegotten, when the character I play, James Tyrone Jr., he cannot accept the love of this woman who is saying to him, "Jim, I will save you. Let me love you. I can save you." And he walks away to his death, or at least to unhappiness. What O'Neill was saying is love cannot save you. We love to think that love is the answer to everything and it will save. Love can't save us. And that to me, like insights like that were tremendously enlightening to me. And I would do the play and I would think to myself, "Oh, well, is that true?" I'm just giving you one example. So I learned so much by being in his plays. And I learned so much about myself. And they're very, very difficult plays to do. And I'm not denying that they're difficult for audiences to sit through. But if you can make the emotion connect with the audience, it's powerful in a way that, say, a movie isn't powerful.
Gabriel Byrne, the time has just flown by, and I want to thank you so much for letting us see you in the honest, revealing way that you've just been talking about with O'Neill, The Mask Is Off, both in this conversation and in your splendid book, Walking with Ghosts. So thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.
Likewise.
You've been listening to Gabriel Byrne in conversation with Stephen Wynn. This program was recorded on January 12th, 2021. The two spoke to one another via video conference. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Randazzo. The post-production director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater technical director, Steve Eckard. House manager, Lucy Faulkner. The recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Hawes Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.